We looked at how abortion became illegal in the first place. Then we looked at the scene from 1910 to 1970 that set the stage for the landmark case. This time, we look at the drama surrounding Roe v. Wade and how abortion became legal in the United States in 1973. That is next. Hey, welcome back to the Barry Frost Show. In 1973, Roe v. Wade made abortion legal. The court divided pregnancy into three trimesters and declared that the choice to end a pregnancy in the first trimester was solely up to the woman. In the second trimester, the government could regulate abortion, although not ban it, in order to protect the mother's health. In the third trimester, the state could prohibit abortion to protect a fetus that could survive on its own outside the womb, except when a woman's health was in danger. Now, before Roe v. Wade became the law of the land, there was a deliberate plan to make that happen. Now, in the first episode in this three-part series, we looked at the five camps of abortion and the history of abortion since 1500 BC. Last time, we looked at the scene from 1910 to 1970 that set the stage for the landmark case. This time, we look at the drama of the 1973 Roe v. Wade ruling. There were two leaks. The real Jane Roe never had an abortion. She later became a pro-life advocate, and the co-conspirator did an about-face and tried to undo all the harm he unleashed. Larry Lader and Dr. Bernard Nathanson set the public relations stage for Roe v. Wade. Now, Dr. Bernard Nathanson was the official voice. He was the professional, the leading expert on all abortions. He had performed more abortions at that time than anyone else, and he spoke confidently of their safety. He repeatedly asserted that there were really no adverse consequences to an abortion and no reason for any guilt for anyone having one. Larry's well-crafted messages and taglines knocked the Catholics off balance and kept them out of the public debate. Larry also used direct and indirect contacts from his Harvard days to get the media and Hollywood singing from the same sheet of music. And Larry's persistent leadership style enticed powerful people like Betty Friedan with National Organization for Women to join the chorus. In New York had set the precedent. In 1970, abortion was now available on demand through 24 weeks. So the plan was coming together. Now to find a case that could be elevated all the way up to the Supreme Court. In 1970, Sarah Weddington, a 26-year-old who had never argued a case, and Linda Coffey were hired to take on the abortion case of 22-year-old Norma McCorvey. Sarah Weddington found it difficult to find a job with a law firm, so she joined a group of graduate students at the University of Texas, and they were researching ways to challenge various anti-abortion statutes. Linda Coffey, 29, was her co-counsel. Linda came up with the idea of calling Norma Jane Roe. Though Sarah led the case arguments in front of the Supreme Court, Linda initially met Norma, and she initiated the co-counsel arrangement. When Norma showed up saying she was seeking an abortion, Linda thought she'd be the perfect client to test their research. Norma McCorvey lived from 1947 to 2017. The idea of making her known only by her pseudonym, Jane Roe, protected Norma, and it made it impossible to put a face or a real story to the case. Norma McCorvey, the Roe in Roe v. Wade, initially claimed she had been raped. Later, she admitted that she wanted an abortion for economic reasons. But during the long and arduous litigation process, she gave birth and put the baby up for adoption. She never had an abortion. But that didn't stop them from filing their case against Henry Wade. Now, Henry Wade lived from 1914 to 2001. He was the district attorney for Dallas County from 1951 to 1987. He's famous for two court cases. After Lee Harvey Oswald assassinated John F. Kennedy, Wade was the guy that was about to prosecute him. But Jack Ruby killed Oswald before he could stand trial. So Wade prosecuted Ruby instead. The jury gave Jack Ruby the death penalty, deciding his case in 3 hours. So that's Wade. The other case that he's famous for is his role as the legal defendant on abortion. He's the defendant because he was the guy responsible for enforcing the law in Texas, and abortion was illegal, except in the instance of saving the life of the mother. They'd be a Camp 1 abortion belief state. So now you know why the case is called Roe versus Wade. Sarah mounted a constitutional challenge to the Texas law. The ultimate result of the 1973 Supreme Court ruling was that all the state laws that banned abortion were void. The lower court refused to grant Roe's desired injunction, but sided with her on the criminal abortion statutes. So both sides appealed. All the way to the Supreme Court. So in 1971, when Sarah Weddington first stated her case in front of the United States Supreme Court, she was only 26 years old, and she had never tried a legal case before. She argued a smattering of legal theories, privacy, and the 14th Amendment. As for Sarah Weddington's attention to legal ethics, here's what she said in 1993. "My conduct might not have been totally ethical, but I did it for what I thought were good reasons," unquote. So she had an ends justify the means Machiavellian value system. Regardless, she won. But there's a bit of drama here. At the time of the first hearing, December 1971, the High Court had only 7 of the 9 justices. President Nixon was trying to fill the 2 open seats. Yet this case was heard with only 7. After the first hearing, the Chief Justice called for an informal vote. The Supreme Court was going to rule 4-3 in favor of overturning the Texas abortion law. Well, the Chief Justice was opposed to abortion, so he pushed for a reconsideration, a rehearing of the case. It's kind of unusual. He argued that the case was too big to decide on only 7 justices. Well, this really ticked off the 4 guys who ruled in favor of abortion on demand, overturning the Texas law. So to them, it looked like all the Chief Justice was really trying to do was wait until Nixon could get his 2 new guys on the bench and then hope that it would go 5-4 against overturning the Texas law. And that did not seem right. One of the justices, William Douglas, was so angered by the rescheduling tactic that he wrote an internal memo. And he argued why it was wrong to reconsider. And he also disclosed in this memo how each justice voted. The memo is signed by William Douglas, the senior justice in favor of making abortion legal for the whole U.S. of A. So first he hand-delivered it to the Chief Justice, giving him a chance, hoping the Chief Justice would change his mind and just let the 4-3 ruling stand. But the Chief Justice didn't budge. So Douglas delivered that memo to each of the justices. Now he multiplied the possibility of what ended up happening. Meanwhile, the public relations guru, Larry Lader, and all his coalition partners in the media were making the daily case for overturning the Texas abortion law. Another justice, who was personally mad at the Chief Justice for a number of other issues and really mad at him for this rescheduling strong-arm tactic, is rumored to have given this memo to the Washington Post. By the way, he should have recused himself since his wife worked for Planned Parenthood. But the memo was his trump card. Now, of course, the media was thrilled to step in and help. The Post published the story on the court's deliberations. The memo showed the vote tally of the draft opinion to make abortion legal. I mean, it's really a horrible disclosure and a breach of trust. No matter where someone stands politically, these deliberations are never supposed to be disclosed. The public's only supposed to see the formal final written opinions for and against a particular ruling. Yet the fear on the side of the 4 that were in favor of making abortion legal was that Nixon's 2 replacements could be solid opposed. And if the 3 held solid, that would make it 5-4, but nobody knew what was going to happen. So this leak was intended to let Larry Lader and his team have a field day, and it did. Articles were written with no alternative media, no social media outlet, but the articles were written lopsided in favor of making abortion legal throughout the country. They made the case for how hard it is to get legislation passed, that this was an opportunity to make it legal and safe for everyone, that if the case went their way, it would resolve the conflict once and for all. Humorously, that it would unify the country. That was their argument. Well, the daughter of one of the 3 justices that had previously voted against overturning the Texas abortion law also worked for Planned Parenthood. And she's rumored to have convinced him to change his vote. Now, I don't know if she did or not, but he did change his vote, whether she's the one who convinced him or not. And the leak placed enormous pressure on the justices. Even the Chief Justice changed his mind due to the public pressure. So the case was re-argued after the 2 new justices got on the court. By this time, each side was able to make their case to the public, but the weight of the public relations campaign was heavily on the side of the pro-abortion community. Hollywood, major magazines, all the major newspapers, all three of the major TV news outlets, and the Supreme Court ruling quoted none other than Larry Lader 7 times. They used Larry's book on abortion, where he just made up facts, as their legal support for the ruling. And then on the eve of announcing the actual results, Time magazine published a sensational scoop that made it sound like the case had already been formally published. It was titled Abortion on Demand. It said it has officially arrived, but the Supreme Court had not yet actually published the ruling. This time, Chief Justice Berger is even more incensed. Trust had been damaged at the court, and an insider had given the Time magazine folks an early peek. But in the end, it didn't matter. The pro-abortion on-demand justices had already made up their mind. It had already signed their opinions. It just hadn't been published yet. And then when it was published, the court had decided 7-2 to legalize abortion within the first trimester of pregnancy. One of Nixon's new appointments and two of the previous opponents, including the Chief Justice, voted in favor of the ruling. So the Supreme Court made abortion legal in 1973. But they did it in a way that sort of broke the court. The court inserted something in the Constitution just out of thin air. Those who wanted abortion on demand couldn't get legislation passed through Congress and the Senate in the 1950s and 60s that would have made abortion legal. So they put all their eggs in the Supreme Court basket. The original argument was legally weak. It was truly an embarrassment from a jurisprudence perspective. As discussed before, there are basically 5 camps of belief on the matter of abortion. You're probably in one of these 5 camps. The first camp believes that abortion's always morally wrong, unless the abortion's solely to prevent the death of the mother. The second camp believes that abortion is mostly morally wrong, but that when competing with other morally bad outcomes, an abortion is the lesser of two evils. The third camp believes that abortion is mostly morally okay up to about the midpoint in the pregnancy. The fourth camp doesn't believe that abortion on demand is morally wrong at all. And the fifth camp believes that abortion is morally right under any circumstances. Now, even if most Americans favor a compromise between Camp 1 and Camp 5, judges are supposed to rule on the law, not bend to public opinion. Overturning Roe versus Wade tosses the issue back to each state. There's no constitutional right to an abortion, and the court should not arbitrarily make law. Most of the Europe and Japan have laws that are more pro-life than Roe versus Wade. That's because they were processed through the legislature, not the courts. The way our system of government works, each of the 5 camps of abortion belief should have had a say. You know, even in Ireland, they managed to find a compromise on abortion by creating a citizens' assembly, which issued recommendations to the government. With this ruling, deep red state legislatures will likely end up with a Camp 1, Camp 2, or Camp 3 compromise, and deep blue state legislatures will likely end up with a Camp 3, 4, or 5 compromise. Now, a couple postscripts. You remember Norma Roe, Jane Roe? In her early years, she had a difficult childhood. She was abused. She had some run-ins with the law. At the time of the pregnancy, that was her 3rd baby. And the other 2 were given up for adoption as well. She had her struggles. But, you know, years after Roe versus Wade was passed, she had second thoughts. And in 1995, she became an evangelical Christian, and she became an advocate of Operation Rescue's campaign to make abortion illegal. In 2003, she asked for the decision to be reversed and put forward evidence that abortion hurts women. She never attended a single day of trial, but she did sign the papers to be the plaintiff, and she said she was a pawn for the abortion activists, and she said that her involvement in the case was the biggest mistake of her life. Remember Dr. Bernard Nathanson? Well, he remorsefully said that he killed or presided over the killing of 60,000 babies. He went from abortion activist to pro-life activist. He narrated the 1984 pro-life film, The Silent Scream. He said what changed his mind was the development of the ultrasound technology. He was in the middle of a real-time abortion, and observing the fingers moving, he just broke down. He couldn't finish the abortion. He quit performing abortions. He converted to a Catholic. And later he said that abortion is the most atrocious Holocaust in the history of the United States. He wrote the book Aborting America, in which he discussed what he called the dishonest beginnings of the abortion movement. He worked with the National Right to Life Committee. He produced a follow-up documentary dealing with late-term abortions. He confessed that he just made up the numbers to direct the media to believe how many deaths were caused by illegal abortions. He confessed in a 1996 autobiography that he's one of those who helped usher in this barbaric age. And then he later developed the vector theory of life. That's the notion that if you don't interfere with things right after conception, left to nature, the baby will develop and it'll lead to the birth of a human baby. In other words, it has all it needs to become a baby. And that is the case. The fetus is living. Dead things don't grow. It isn't a blob. The person in the womb directs his or her own internal growth. He or she develops herself. The child is whole. He or she already has everything he or she needs to realize his or her full growth. He or she just needs time to realize all his or her properties. This has been proven by science. You can look it up. As to the argument that it's the mom's body and it's her choice, that's not really scientific. The Catholics have been proven scientifically right. The womb creates an environment for the fetus to grow into either a boy or a girl. And all that is put in motion at conception. After the egg is released from the ovary, it travels into the fallopian tube. It stays there until a single sperm fertilizes it. That's out of the 40 million to 150 million sperm that are swimming upstream toward the fallopian tubes on their mission to fertilize an egg. But only a few hundred will even come close to the egg because of the many natural barriers that exist in a woman's body. But in about 24 hours, the winning sperm, that cell, will fertilize an egg. And when the sperm penetrates the egg, the surface of the egg builds this protective barrier so that no other sperm can enter. In the moment of fertilization, at that moment, the baby's genetic makeup is complete, including whether it's a boy or girl. So when is it alive? I mean, let's be real. There are honest people who have honest disagreements here, but the window has narrowed. I mean, a few hundred years ago, the majority thought life didn't happen until there was obvious evidence of the pregnancy, where you could put your hand on the tummy and hear and feel movement. They called it the quickening. And until the 1800s, that was thought to be about halfway through the pregnancy. But the same thing that changed Dr. Bernard Nathanson has changed the minds of millions of others and a lot of young people. It's ultrasound technology. It's so high resolution that it's hard for any casual observer to argue that the baby's not alive after just a few weeks of pregnancy. I mean, you can go online and you can see for yourself thousands of crystal clear videos and pictures. You can see the fertilized egg. It starts growing fast. It leaves that fallopian tube and it enters the uterus 3 to 4 days after it's fertilized. You can see that after it gets to the uterus, the fertilized egg attaches to the lining of the uterus. And you can see that after the egg attaches to the uterus, that some cells become the placenta while others become the embryo. And you can see the fetus at 8 weeks. So when do you think life begins? As a human rights issue, I mean, isn't that really the question that should be addressed? For those who deny any spiritual concepts, as science continues to develop, the window for when life begins continues to shrink. With today's super high resolution imagery, you can see the baby move around very early. You can read on any conception egg to embryo website that the brain, spinal cord, heart, and other organs begin to form early. You know, the heart beats at week 5. An honest, secular observer would have to say that life begins either at conception or within a few weeks after that. There's no doubt that allowing states to decide for themselves will result in wide differences. In about half the states, most abortions will become illegal. The other half will allow them on demand. Some will allow them all the way through 9 months. Others will prohibit them when they think life begins. You know, the West has been arguing about this challenging moral issue for over 2,500 years. Most Western democracies have found a compromise between the far left position that abortions on demand should always be available and the most conservative position that any abortion is murder. In Australia, Britain, Canada, France, Germany, and Japan, legislatures have allowed abortion early in pregnancy but made them illegal later. But notice that in those countries, the legislature solved the problem. The legislature works closest to the people. The U.S. solved the problem in 1973 by fiat from the Supreme Court, and it only created division. Overturning Roe versus Wade simply sends the decision back to the states to force the legislative body to sort it out. I'm for life, and I believe in limited government. But if government should do anything, it should protect innocent life to your freedom.
Hi, I'm David Farah. Thank you for listening to my dad's podcast, The Barry Farah Show, Culture Shift. Click subscribe now to be sure you don't miss an episode. Share this podcast with your friends on social media and give The Barry Farah Show your 5-star rating. See you next time.